Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Scottsdale has a new brand. After an 18-month process, what used to be called the Scottsdale Convention and Visitors Bureau has been renamed Experience Scottsdale and will be trying to bring visitors to town with its new effortless revitalization brand. Rachel Sacco is president and CEO of Experience Scottsdale, and she joins me. And Rachel, this seems like a pretty concerted effort to change the way people think and talk about Scottsdale.
Well, you know, we've been very successful in the tourism arena, but we never take anything for granted. And one of my views is that the time to really look forward, the time to really look ahead and recalibrate your brand or your ad campaign is absolutely when you are on top of your game. And that seems to also be the hard part, because that's the time when everyone's like, oh no, this is great, don't change. So for us, we knew that as we're coming out of the downturn and people are coming back to Scottsdale, but it was time for us to really do some research and figure out, what are our customers thinking? And equally important, what are customers, potential customers who have never been to Scottsdale, what are they thinking?
When you talk to folks who both had been to Scottsdale and those who were potential visitors who hadn't been there, what kinds of things did they tell you that when they thought of Scottsdale came to mind?
Well, one of the things that we learned was that the desert is still one of our biggest differentiators. In a way, it's our ocean. And yet, even though the desert is really intriguing to people and it sets us apart, the way in which we were communicating in the past about the desert wasn't necessarily the most effective way. What we learned is that desert as a word, unless you've actually been here, can conjure up negative things. It can conjure up, well, is it hot? Is the desert dangerous? And what we heard over and over again is that just because we talk about the Sonoran Desert and we show a beautiful picture of it, what we really need to do is address some of the myths and misconceptions about the desert. And that became the basis of our campaign.
Do you find that the visitors who are interested in some of the outdoorsy stuff, going into the desert, hiking, that sort of thing, are those the same folks? Is that the same audience that's interested in sort of what Scottsdale has traditionally been known for, which is resorts and golfing and high-end shopping, that sort of thing?
You know, what's interesting is that even people who say, oh, I love the desert, I'm intrigued by it, they may never even go hiking. They may never even do anything more than drive by and just look at it. And what we have found is that all of those things that our historical visitors have always enjoyed about Scottsdale, whether it be, oh, it's got a Western feel to it, oh, there's great culinary there, oh, I love the art galleries and the culture there, or I love golf, I love resort and spa. And while they aren't necessarily the main focus of our TV commercial or our print ads, those stories are continuing to be told every time we meet with a journalist.
I'm wondering how you think this new campaign will fit in with some of those things, as you mentioned, that Scottsdale has traditionally been known for, most notably, you know, the motto of the West's most Western town. How do these all meld together, do you think?
We at Experience Scottsdale have not used that tagline. It's a city tagline, although we certainly admit that the West is something that you can experience here, and it will be one of the stories that we tell. The West doesn't have to be about a shootout at the OK Corral. For many people, it's about being able to wear denim and jeans and turquoise and a beautiful concho belt and a cowboy hat, which you can do here and feel very much like you are okay and you're in the swim of things. It might be going to the Western Museum. It might be going to one of our resorts and sitting out by a beautiful fire and smelling mesquite wood. So the West is definitely experienced here. It's a very rich story that still exists. So I don't see any contradiction to that. We haven't used the West most Western town as our tagline because we feel that there's so much more to tell in some of those stories. And that's why we feel that the Experience Scottsdale logo and brand really gives us more license to tell all of those stories.
Rachel Sacco is president and CEO of the newly named Experience Scottsdale.
You've probably heard it said that the Fourth Avenue Jail in downtown Phoenix is the state's largest mental health facility. That's because so many people with serious mental illness end up behind bars every day. But to the people who run health care in the jail, that's not where they belong.
Now a new program is working to flag people with mental illness when they're booked and get them out as quickly as they can. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to the jail to find out more.
It's 7:50 on a Monday night, and Gary Peltier is standing outside of the 4th Avenue Jail in downtown Phoenix, waiting for someone to be released at exactly 8 p.m.
Marco? How you doing, buddy?
Marco walks out of the towering jail, holding a plastic bag filled with belongings he had with him when he was arrested, shakes Peltier's hand, takes his belt out of the bag, and starts to put it on.
Have you heard about what the program entails?
Well, this is the first time I've heard about it.
Peltier is an engagement specialist with Southwest Behavioral Health Services Criminal Justice Engagement Team. Every day, at three specific times a day, team members like him wait outside of our county jails to pick people up just as they're released.
We're a wraparound service, a 90-day wraparound service.
Marco was released after just one night in jail by a judge before charges were ever filed against him and after he agreed to work with Peltier's team.
And from here, we'll go down. I don't know if usually we... I stopped and got you a sandwich. I don't know if you're hungry. I know that the jailhouse food isn't really worth writing home.
The Criminal Justice Engagement Team works with people who have been diagnosed with a serious mental illness, like Marco, and have been arrested for relatively minor crimes.
You know, it's one goal after another, whether it be a driver's license or navigating through the court system. And what most importantly is the encouragement and the hope, you know, that we can give them.
It's a peer support program run by people like Peltier, who have been through substance abuse treatment or mental health treatment before.
You know, I've been through it myself. You know, I've been in jail. I've been down at CAS.
From here, Peltier will take Marco to their offices at CAS, Central Arizona Shelter Services, the sprawling homeless campus in Phoenix, and spend an hour and a half asking him a series of questions about his illness, his medications, his history, his clinic. Tonight, they'll make sure he has a safe place to sleep. Tomorrow, he'll meet with his new case manager.
It's a triage, you know, we're a triage team.
Rachel Zamora is a senior team leader. She says as soon as someone is identified as seriously mentally ill in the jail, they get the referral and they get to work.
We send out the team. The team will then call the release desk.
The quick turnaround saves their clients from deteriorating behind bars and saves the entire system money, according to Zamora.
The idea is that it's very quick, within a 24-hour time frame, that we get the referral and we meet with the individual.
The Criminal Justice Engagement Team was launched in February of this year as a spinoff of the Smart Justice Program, which aims to keep low-risk offenders out of the criminal justice system and help them stay out.
They're not offenses toward a person or even toward property. It's mainly misdemeanor offenses, drink public intoxication, maybe a petty theft, stealing cigarettes out of a Circle K.
Ken Curry, the program's director, says their clients are people who are mentally ill and often go undiagnosed. Then they start self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. Homelessness and jail are often not far behind.
When you have someone who is mentally ill and homeless, and their options are very few, they're not on medications, well, sometimes their behavior is dictated by their circumstances.
And those kinds of crimes, he says, don't warrant the expense it costs to house someone in jail when the underlying problem is going untreated.
How much does it cost for people to be in jail versus how much does it cost to provide these kinds of programs?
According to Dr. Don Nagel, the mental health director for Maricopa Correctional Health Services, for someone with serious mental illness, spending a few nights in jail could derail their treatment, allow their illness to progress, and create a dangerous pattern.
The criminal justice system is not the answer for the seriously mentally ill. We should work at every opportunity to keep them from coming to jail, divert them when they come, and to work towards them not coming back.
I wish they had this when I was in jail.
Peltier has done a couple dozen pickups outside of the jails in the few months he's worked for the Criminal Justice Engagement Team. And there's only one hiccup.
You know, unfortunately, some don't take the services and some fail. But, you know, some turn the failure into a positive.
That's right. Some of their clients walk out of jail to meet the team and just walk away. And that's allowed.
They have no obligation to come back, you know.
Curry says that's an important part of it, actually. It has to be their choice. Because help with addiction only works when you're ready to take it. And he says every day in this program, people are taking their help.
But they don't have to. But they're there every day. They're coming back because they want to sit with it. They want to get away from the nonsense, and they're trying, you know, baby steps to change their lives, and that's a good sign.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled the Federal Environmental Protection Agency was right to accept Arizona's plan to reduce its air pollution, specifically particulate matter known as PM10. The plan aimed to reduce PM10 emissions by at least 5% over a five-year period, but the so-called 5% plan also didn't include more than 130 exceptional events where those emissions exceeded air quality standards. Sandy Barr was one of the plaintiffs challenging the EPA's acceptance of the plan. She's the director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club. And Sandy, first off, what's your reaction to the ruling?
Well, first of all, I would say they accepted it in part. So it's disappointing that the court thought it was okay that EPA accepted 135 exceedances of the air quality standard as exceptional events. And that's really how the Maricopa County area has been able to demonstrate attainment with these health-based air quality standards, is by including a lot of exceedances as exceptional events and basically, you know, kind of throwing up their hands and saying we didn't have any control over them. I would like to add, though, that the court did say that you can't just throw some contingency measures into your plan and have EPA rubber stamp those, that contingency measures have to be real and they can't be something you've already implemented.
Well, let me ask you about those exceedances. And basically the state was arguing that many, if not all of them, were accounted for by dust storms or monsoon activity that brought dust storms. In your mind, how many of those 135 were actually sort of out of the state's or out of environmental regulators' hands?
Well, certainly part of it is, well, you have a big dust storm. For how many days does it become an exceptional event? Would you be able to take measures to make sure that the dust doesn't continue to get churned up? Clearly, some of them would fit into the exceptional event definition, but that, you know, this was excessive because the bottom line is, the air is unhealthful. You know, I can't give you an exact number right now, but there certainly were a number of these that should have been eliminated from consideration.
Going forward, what kinds of things would you like to see done to try to mitigate the effects of some of those dust storms and maybe keep some of the dust or get some of the dust back on the ground once it's in the air?
Well, for the long term, we obviously need to look at climate change, but that is not going to help us in the short term. But yeah, in the short term, we can limit how much land is disturbed, especially all at once. We've brought this up before, provisions that require just-in-time grading. So rather than, you know, going out and blading massive swaths of land, you grade as you build. More limits on how agricultural activities are implemented. And, you know, again, you know, plowing up massive fields, you know, and really having a lot of soil disturbed all at once, you know, limiting activities when we have high wind days. You know, we live in a big city. There are a lot of people, and we all need to be responsible. And when people aren't responsible, there needs to be some enforcement.
So what's next for you on this? I mean, are there more appeals that you can do? Or are you going to try to work to maybe get some of the other actions that you just mentioned into either city ordinance or state law, something like that?
Yeah, we're going to continue to work on improving air quality. We also have some big ozone issues we need to address, which is also very unhealthy. But on this specifically, next up is working on those contingency measures to make sure that they're real and to make sure that they kick in, you know, when they're needed.
Sandy Barr is the director of the Grand Canyon chapter of the Sierra Club.
It's a huge understatement, but Grand Canyon National Park is home to a wide variety of plant species, more than 1,500 in fact. A lot of that is credited to the dramatic elevation change in the canyon. But leaders of the park wanted to do something to help protect more of those plants, so the nonprofit Grand Canyon Association worked with the park to help raise funds to construct a greenhouse on the site. To learn more, I'm joined by Ann Shefflin, the Chief Philanthropy Officer for the Grand Canyon Association. And Ann, how did this come about?
Many people may not know that one of the important resources at Grand Canyon National Park is our vegetation. And we have a special crew of Park Service employees that we affectionately call the Veg Crew, who is out and about in the park. Their goal and mission is to conserve and steward native plant communities and rare species within the park. You may know that the park's 1.2 million acres, so it's a really big job. We've had a nursery and a greenhouse at the park for many years, but it was one of those buildings that was sort of put together with, you know, those white pipe fittings that, you know, any one of us could pick up at Home Depot. And it was one of those large structures that had almost a tarp over it. It had no heating controls, and it was very challenging for the veg crew.
And how was it determined that a new greenhouse was what was needed in the park?
The idea for the new greenhouse was, I guess we could say, to use a pun, germinated when they started to realize that they could probably grow a lot of the native plants right at the park. So prior to that, most of our grasses and many of our cuttings were sent out of state, either to California or to New Mexico, where plants were propagated and then they were trucked back here. So the idea for our new greenhouse really was that we would be able to grow from seeds and cuttings our own native plants for use throughout the park. And so now we have this incredible state-of-the-art building. We have the ability in the new greenhouse to have different climate controls. So as you may know, the canyon is home to 7 life zones, and those range from 2,000 to 7,000 feet in elevation. And we're able to duplicate those climates in our own greenhouse. So we're able to grow a great variety of plants that we can use throughout the park. The new greenhouse has enabled the park to save, we're estimating, somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000 a year because we no longer have to go to neighboring states to grow our plants.
When you're actually taking care of the plants and growing them in California and bringing them out here, were there any complications related to that having a greenhouse now relieves?
Well, I don't know, Steve, that that's the case, but certainly it isn't exactly, it isn't carbon neutral, and it isn't, the Grand Canyon National Park is a leader in conserving our natural resources, and this was not a very efficient way to grow plants. So we're just delighted that we have the capacity right here at home to grow our own plants. One of the ways that the park works, we do have a number of invasive species at the park. You know, some people who have been running the river may be familiar with our tamarisk, which has really kind of overrun some of the most popular beaches along the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that we deal with that is the veg crews go in and they cut down the tamarisk. But then it's really important to have native plants to reseed those areas because we want to be sure that we offer shade and that we're returning the areas back to the native ecosystems. And so really the greenhouse is where all those plants are grown. So this enables us then to go in to reclaim the beaches and to replant them with native plants.
Ann Shefflin is Chief Philanthropy Officer for the Grand Canyon Association, which raised $350,000 to help build the canyon's new greenhouse. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Rachel. I'm here at the Cash Nightclub and Lounge on a Tuesday night taking a line dancing lesson.
So, there, double left.
And I like it because there's a lot of muscle memory that goes into it, you know, because you do the same dance 8 or 9 different times, just facing different directions. And one person will turn around and face everyone and high-five them or flirt with them.
Touch, good.
Oh my God. program in the back row.
It brings people to the dance floor. You see people learning it on the side, and you, come on, come join us. And they break it down to where anybody who's never stepped foot on a dance floor before can do it.
Oh, there we go. Excellent. Give us a round of applause.
That's Rachel Burns learning a new line dance. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to tell us we have four left feet, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
The system of liver transplants in the U.S. could be changing. The United Network for Organ Sharing, or UNOS, is working on new maps and guidelines that aim to make that system fair and more equitable across the country. Dr. Ryutaro Hiroshi is leading that effort. He's a transplant surgeon at UC San Francisco and chair of the UNOS Liver Intestinal Organ Transplant Committee, which is charged with writing allocation and distribution policies for liver transplants.
The problem of the current system as it exists right now is that we use a map of the United States that's divided up into 11 fairly sizable regions, and those regions are further divided up into a total of 58 smaller areas. And these areas, the boundaries of these areas were determined many, many years ago, actually decades ago, way before we had liver transplantation even as an accepted form of therapy. But in any event, what we do right now is we distribute organs fairly locally and then regionally using these 58 donor service areas and 11 regions. And the boundaries of these regions have created a situation in which there's a fair amount of disparity or inequity in the system as relates to geography. So the place that you live in and where you register for transplant largely determines, once you're on the wait list, whether you're going to get a liver pretty soon or when you're not so sick versus in other areas of the country where you have to get much sicker or achieve a higher priority score to get a transplant. The new proposal that's out for public comment right now seeks to try to ameliorate these inequities and disparities, to try to change the map to encourage broader distribution areas to equalize the access for transplant by geography in this country.
Based on some of the reading I've done about this, it seems as though Arizona is a fairly easy place where if you need a liver, you would be able to get one. Under these new guidelines, would it become more difficult or would it stay relatively the same in a place like Arizona?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, Arizona is in a region, it's the region number is called Region 5. And Arizona and California are both in areas that the livers are not particularly available. And it's hard to say what would happen to a certain area of the country or certain donor service areas. It really depends upon the wait list and center behavior in terms of accepting organs. So it's hard to say a priori whether the folks in Arizona would have a harder time or easier time to get a liver.
What ideally is the maximum amount of time that somebody should have to wait for a liver, given that everybody's medical condition is slightly different and, you know, every case is individual? But is there sort of a goal that you're shooting for here?
No, I don't think it should be measured in terms of wait list time. The reason for that is some folks are really sick when they first show up to the hospital, and they will die within the next 7 days. Those folks should get a transplant within the next 7 days. There are folks that show up to a liver transplant center with years and years of time on their hands because their liver is not so sick. So right now, the way that the list is ordered is not by how much time you have spent on the list, but by urgency, by medical urgency. In other words, the amount of time that a patient waits on the wait list per se is not great, but if you take a certain cohort of patients that have the same degree of illness, I believe we should try to equalize the chance that you'll get a transplant given a certain degree of illness.
Dr. Ryutaro Hiroshi is a transplant surgeon at UC San Francisco and chair of the UNOS Liver Intestinal Organ Transplant Committee. The current proposal is up for public comment for another few weeks, although Hiroshi is not sure when any new maps or guidelines would take effect. Any changes would presumably have impacts across the country and obviously here in Arizona. With me to talk about that is Dr. Winston Hewitt, a transplant surgeon at the Mayo Clinic and Phoenix Children's Hospital. And Dr. Hewitt, do you think the proposed changes would make it easier or harder for potential recipients in Arizona to get a liver.
It's such a complicated equation because it's not just about which region or which city or which state that you're in with regard to whether you're likely to be transplanted or not. It also has to do with the severity of your illness. And then, just as importantly, it's the philosophy of your transplant center and the physicians and surgeons that work there. Because there are some surgeons and transplant physicians who are willing to accept a more, quote-unquote, marginal liver than other transplant centers. So the fact that it could increase or decrease availability of organs, yes, has to do with the population that you're dealing with the district that you're in, with the organ donation rates for the other states that are in your regions, but also if the transplant surgeon or physician is not willing to accept an organ that's a little bit older, for example, or is going to have a little bit more what's called cold ischemia time, meaning it's going to have to come from further, then it doesn't matter whether you're offered the organ or not. The recipient might get skipped over. So I think there is going to be a sort of recalibration in the acceptable limits of this cold ischemia time with organ quality-based issues that every transplant center is going to have to struggle with and ultimately come to a conclusion on what they think is acceptable.
Has it been your experience that your patients who need liver transplants are able to get the organ?
Yes. Our center and myself, we tend to be relatively aggressive with regard to accepting various criteria that the donor may have in order to get that precious organ.
Have your patients been asking you about what these new guidelines or what the new map might be and what it might mean for them?
Some of them have. Not a tremendous amount of them have, because given the nature of liver disease, sometimes you have encephalopathy or confusion involved with the disease process itself, and sometimes they're just not, you know, mentally facile enough to understand what that fully means. Patients' family members and potential living liver donors, for example, are very much aware of all this, and they want to know what this means with regard to should they have to be a living donor, for example, or will their loved one get a liver faster, in which case they don't need to donate part of their liver.
Well, what kinds of things do you tell them about sort of where the process is and assuming that some kind of change goes through, be it what's on the table now or some modified version of that, what do you tell them about what that might mean for them?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think we all struggle with giving as a definitive answer with regard to questions like that. And what I tell them is that no one really knows what this is going to mean with regard to waiting time, whether this is going to add significantly or shorten significantly. I suspect it's going to be neither. It's going to be a minimal perturbation given our geographic location, given how aggressive our organ acceptance policies are. I also tell them that it's going to take a while before it fully goes into effect. And even when it goes into effect, all of that data with regard to the effect on waiting times will be analyzed and monitored continually. And if there is a tremendous unanticipated negative result or impact, that will come out and things may change yet again. I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that everyone within transplantation wants as fair and equitable distribution of this precious resource as possible. And what that sometimes means is that there's going to be change, and change is uncomfortable.
Dr. Winston Hewitt is a transplant surgeon at the Mayo Clinic and Phoenix Children's Hospital. We are talking about proposed changes to the current maps used in liver transplants.
Bullhead City sits on the Colorado River right near the junction of California, Nevada, and Arizona, and residents take pride in their riverfront properties and parks. But those calm days on the river have been disrupted as swarms of insects called caddisflies have invaded. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports from our West Valley Bureau, the city has invested in research to find out what's really bugging the locals.
Again, they're resting in these shaded areas on the side of the dock. As soon as you walk under here, you're going to be surrounded in them.
Joe Eiberg walks along the Colorado River, sparkling in the morning sun, picking up his low-tech research traps. They're sticky yellow rectangles he set up in three different locations, each a little farther from the Davis Dam. At this particular spot on the river, the caddisflies are out in droves. It's hard to even talk without some flying in your mouth.
Oh, God. I'm going to keep my mouth as closed as possible.
That's why they needed somebody to come study this.
Iberg is an entomologist and was recently hired by Bullhead City to study why these bugs have suddenly come to the area. He uses the traps to see where the highest concentration is.
Most places in the country where caddisflies are become a problem, it's only for a couple of weeks. Here they can be reach nuisance levels for months out of the year.
Caddisflies are harmless, moth-looking insects about an inch long. They come out in the early fall and stick around in the cooler months. Iberg thinks the swarm could be connected to fertilizers getting into the water, but won't know for sure until he's done more research. It's not the first time Bullhead City has dealt with river bugs. The city has had a tax-funded pest abatement district for 32 years. It was first established to get rid of the black flies that plagued locals back in 1984. Iberg is also tasked with controlling mosquitoes in local soccer fields that bring in tournaments and tourism money to the area.
And this is where people are getting bit more than anywhere else, are on these fields right next to where the mosquitoes are coming from. So let's see if we can find one.
He takes me to the fields and we study stagnant little puddles from irrigation, a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes. We look for signs of the bug, but don't find any because he's already treated the area with a larvicide.
I won't have any mosquitoes to show you, which is a good thing for the city, hopefully.
It is a good thing because this type of mosquito is so aggressive, it can bite through clothing, driving soccer players and their families away. And by hiring a bug expert, city manager Toby Cotter hopes to head off any potential loss to tourism.
It would be devastating to our economy. So we have to keep our tourism economy strong. Part of that is making sure that the environment itself is not impacted.
Cotter says the economy's not been affected yet, but with the recent caddisfly issue, local realtors say their business has taken a hit.
They were showing riverfront homes, and the potential buyers were saying, whoa, where are these normal?
Follow the river south a ways and you hit Camino del Rio, a street lined with million-dollar homes like the one built by resident Wayne Spradling and his wife Phyllis.
I find them in the house everywhere, on the floor, on the counter here.
The Spradlings' all-white home on the river is meticulously clean and provides a stark contrast to the dark brown caddisflies all over the windows and doors. Phyllis gives me a tour and laments how the pests have hurt the property value and keep her from enjoying the retired life.
This has been going on for like 5-6 years. This is horrible. I feel bad for all of us on the river because our property, we can't enjoy it. I don't know how everybody else enjoys it, but it's really bad.
The Spradlings have been here for more than 25 years and are hoping for a bug solution. Pest abatement manager Joe Iberg will continue to study the caddisflies to understand why they are just emerging now and how to control them. Some current theories are that because there are less trout stocked in the Colorado, the caddisflies have been able to breed out of control, or it could be connected to more algae growth in certain parts of the river. Whatever the cause, the Spradlings and their neighbors will just have to learn to coexist with the small winged creatures for now. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Bullhead City.
For the Orthodox Jewish community, sundown on Friday is not just the start of the weekend, but also the start of the Sabbath, which extends to sundown Saturday. It's a time of religious reflection, and according to Jewish law, no work can be done. In this case, work includes lots of things, like driving a car or carrying something outside of your house.
That can make it hard to do anything outside the home on the Sabbath if you can't even carry your house key outside with you. But there's a way around that if the community puts up something called an eruv. That's a physical boundary around a neighborhood or city that acts as an extension of the home. The public space becomes a symbolic private space and allows people to carry outside. The show's Annika Klein takes us inside one Valley Eruv.
Robin Meyerson has 5 children. They live in walking distance of their synagogue. But before their local Erev was completed in 2013, she stayed home with the kids on the Sabbath because of not being able to carry outside the house.
That includes, like, you can't carry your child, you can't carry a water bottle, you can't carry items. I couldn't really have guests over either for lunch or dinner because they couldn't come themselves because of their kids. So it'd be kind of lonely, to tell you the truth.
Now she can have guests and the whole family goes to synagogue.
So I get to pray and be in the synagogue, listen to the speeches. And so it's enriching my life to have that ability to go to the synagogue.
And that's the thing. An eruv affects lifestyle so much. Meyerson says people even decide whether to move to an area based on whether it has one.
My name is Dan.
What I do full time is I'm a realtor. That's my real job. But I also work for the Arrow.
Right now, we're at Dan Zupnik's second job, to check the Arrow that surrounds all of Paradise Valley. We're driving around in Scottsdale at the 101 and Frank Lloyd Wright Boulevard.
So the northern boundary is the Central Arizona Project Canal.
The canal fence creates part of the Arrow, along with the sound barriers against the 101 and the 51. But the Arrow has to be seamless, no gaps.
Like, here's our pole here, and we have a string that comes across. You can kind of see it faintly in the sky. It goes to that light pole.
Zupnik points out some fishing line between two poles. It's strung over a road that cuts through the canal fence. This closes the gap in the fencing and makes the Arrow whole.
And then we just have a whole bunch of them go light pole right here.
It's meant to be unobtrusive. If you blink, you'll miss it.
So we're on this fence right now because we had a pole that came across. So we're carrying this fence, and then you're going to see right here.
Zupnik's been doing this for 3 years. Every week, he plays a giant game of connect the dots, checking each and every one of these spots. There's 52 total. And if a line is down, it has to be repaired before the Sabbath, or the Arrow is no good. We park to check out a line Zupnik can't see while driving.
There's a little walking path that goes between that and the sound barrier wall for the freeway.
When Zupnik is done today, he'll update a website and email list to let the community know the Arrow is good to go for this week's Sabbath. There are three other Orthodox synagogues within the boundary of this Arrow around Paradise Valley, which was built thanks to Ariel Shoshan.
My wife and I moved from Baltimore to Phoenix in 2002, and we had had an Arrow in Baltimore. In Phoenix, we didn't.
Shoshan is rabbi of a congregation called Ahavas Torah in Scottsdale. This Arrow project initially cost $150,000, and there are ongoing costs for maintenance and repair.
In fact, last year, we had to have two redesigns because of changes along the 101 at 90th Street and because of the city of Scottsdale changes along the bike path that's behind the waterfront buildings.
But the challenges of literally intersecting an old tradition through a modern city don't faze Shoshan. He's happy the project came together after talks with the cities, utility companies, and an Indian reservation that it impacts.
This is written about in what we call the Mishnah from thousands of years ago. But now there are practical examples of it, and it does, without a doubt, make the observance of the Sabbath more real.
And it means residents like Robin Meyerson can look forward to sharing the Sabbath with the rest of the community.
You feel like you're in Jerusalem a little bit. You feel like you're in a bigger community because you can get together with other people.
But instead of limestone walls, this city is surrounded by wire and brick fencing and fishing line, as strong as any wall to the community inside it. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
The art of sculpture continues to evolve. It isn't exactly new that artists like to experiment with different and newer materials or go back to very well-established ones. Legos are going through their own sort of renaissance among sculptors of all ages. Mary Neubauer is a professor of art and sculpture at ASU and is with me to talk more about sculpting. Mary, are we seeing a real expansion in the types of materials being used, and does that affect the art's sustainability?
In the 19th century, going into the 20th century, the definition of sculpture was bronze or marble. The subject matter was usually, well, we think of it as neoclassical, but they referred to the classical movements, most often figures, either mythology or events in the political or civic life of a people. So it was a storytelling kind of sculpture. And as well, you'd see animals, but always it was realistic subject matter. And that was part of the Art Academy of the 19th century. But really the first revolutionaries were the Russian constructivists. And in Russia, they were interested at the turn of the century in things like science fiction, space travel, and of course all the new materials that were coming out with the Industrial Revolution having happened.
Was there a need to use these kinds of materials? Was it just a natural fit?
I think it was a natural fit. I think artists are experimenters, and they're always eager to look into new materials and use them. It's, I think, part of their creative spirit. The Industrial Revolution brought forth plastics and nylons and structural steels, and artists adopted them. Oftentimes, artists very quickly adopt what comes on the scene culturally or industrially.
Is it important for art to be done and sculpture to be done on materials that can survive for decades or centuries and even longer? And with the materials we're using more over the past century or so. Are we going to see less of that?
Yes and no. When you look at artists experimenting with traditional materials, and I'll cite one artist, Red Grooms. He did a piece, Ruckus Manhattan, all made out of plastics and paper mache, and it was a life-size replica of Manhattan, or almost. It was a city block size. As Red Grooms became better known, he became more collectible. Collectors in museums sometimes demand more archival materials. So that's when you see sculptors coming from their young years where they're experimenting. They don't have much money. They're using all kinds of materials and then becoming more collectible and going to more archival materials. Bronze is still one of the most archival materials. So a lot of times things take a translation into bronze. From the early experimentations of the artists, they go to collectability as they move into fame.
What popped into my mind were 3D printers.
Right.
And using that sort of thing. Uh-huh. What do you make of the drastic changes that may be coming around the corner because of high tech?
High tech is a really interesting field. That's the field that I work in because I use 3D printers to realize my models that I later will turn into more permanent materials like bronze or marble. I'm an artist who works between those two traditions. I use the old. I was trained in the old, but I use it in a new way through numbers and computers. But if you look at the way computers look at art or scan things or make things for 3D printing, there were analogs to that centuries ago. They weren't digitally scanning, but they were scanning in an analog way. And so we think of it as a huge revolution, and the digital world is revolutionary because it makes things a lot faster. But the knowledge structure behind how things are realized digitally is pretty old. So in a way, it's a revolution, but in a way, it's always been there. We've just found through computers a faster way of realizing it. Most art foundries now, art fabricators, will ask for a digital file or they'll make a digital file. If a traditional sculptor comes in with a model, they'll digitally scan it in order to enlarge it. 100 years ago, they were using a pointing machine, which would be the analog method of doing the same thing.
Mary Neubauer, art and sculpture professor in ASU's School of Art.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.